From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the emerging New Peace Movement. We take a look at the new organizers and issues with Todd Gitlin. He was an activist in the peace movement of the 60s. He was president of SDS from 1963 to 64. He opposes a U.S. war against Iraq, but he's troubled by what he describes as the old left orthodoxies of the group that organized Saturday's march in Washington, the Answer Coalition. Also, we talk with one of the organizers of the march, Mara Verheiden Hilliard. She's on the steering committee of the Answer Coalition. And we hear from Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. He's also co-chair of the new coalition Win Without War, which is organizing many anti-war demonstrations. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A senior Pentagon official is charging that Saddam Hussein has threatened to kill any Iraqi scientist who cooperates with UN weapons inspectors. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz says the United States is nevertheless giving inspectors the names of Iraqi scientists with knowledge of secret weapons programs. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The Bush administration has argued from the beginning of the weapons inspection process that more can be learned from interviewing Iraqi scientists than from any other inspection activity. More recently, administration officials have argued that Saddam's blockage of private interviews is a clear sign he is not really cooperating with the inspection process. And speaking in New York, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz added a new charge.
Today we know from multiple sources that Saddam has ordered that any scientist who cooperates during interviews will be killed, as well as their families.
Wolfowitz did not say how the United States knows this. He also alleged Iraqi scientists are being tutored on what to tell the UN inspectors. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
South Korea and North Korea say they've agreed to negotiations aimed at resolving the crisis over the North's nuclear weapons program. Negotiators from the South issued a separate statement, however, saying the North has been unwilling to compromise on its plan to reactivate a nuclear reactor or to produce enriched uranium that could be used in weapons. Gunmen killed three Israelis today in an attack near the West Bank city of Hebron. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The three Israelis were ambushed in a sparsely populated area of the West Bank south of Hebron. Israeli security officials said they believed the gunmen fled to a nearby Palestinian village. Both the Islamist Hamas movement and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility. Hebron, where about 500 Jewish settlers live among more than 100,000 Palestinians, has been a flashpoint of violence. The latest attack comes just 5 days before Israel's parliamentary elections, in which hardline parties are expected to gain strength. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's Likud party is expected to garner at least 30 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Senator Bob Graham of Florida said today that he'll postpone announcing that he's a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. Graham, who's 66, said that he's scheduled to have heart surgery to replace a faulty aortic valve during the week of February 3rd, the same week he'd been planning to announce his presidential bid. Graham said that he'll wait a month after having the surgery, then decide whether to run. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 51 points to close at 8,369 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 29, or more than 2%, to close at 1,388. This is NPR News. Kuwait's Interior Ministry said today that a 25-year-old government worker has confessed to killing one American civilian and wounding another in an ambush this week. Officials say the man shared the beliefs of Osama bin Laden. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says he's disappointed that the Republican-led Senate has defeated his drought relief plan and approved a smaller relief package instead. Brian Bull reports from South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Daschle says his bill would have provided $6 billion of emergency aid to affected farmers and ranchers. In his home state of South Dakota, the Agriculture Department reports $2 billion in losses from the drought. But instead of Daschle's plan, a Republican version was approved that allocates $3.1 billion for ag producers in designated disaster areas. Daschle says his plan would have helped cattlemen and farmers more.
Unfortunately, the Republicans cut it in half and said that anyone was eligible regardless of whether they had a loss or not. I'm very disappointed with the outcome. We're just going to keep fighting until we get this done right.
Daschle says the Republican plan does mean some relief to struggling farmers, but those who don't live in designated disaster areas will go unaided. For NPR News, I'm Brian Bull in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Marxist rebels in Colombia say they're holding an American photographer and a British reporter who entered rebel-controlled territory in one of the country's most violent regions. Scott Dalton of Conroe, Texas, and British citizen Ruth Morris were on assignment for the Los Angeles Times. A guerrilla group called the National Liberation Army said it would hold the two for an unspecified length of time, depending on political and military conditions. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Michigan, whose $1 billion Michigan Life Sciences Corridor Initiative is bringing minds and research to Michigan. Information available at michigan.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The anti-war movement is growing. Last Saturday, demonstrations in Washington, San Francisco, and other cities protested against a U.S. war with Iraq. We're going to look at this new movement. My first guest is Todd Gitlin. He has logged many miles at peace demonstrations over the years. He was president of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, from 1963 to 64, and was active in the movement against the war in Vietnam. He wrote about political protests in his book, The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. His book, Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives, is now out in paperback. His book, Letters to a Young Activist, will be published in the spring. Gitlin is against a U.S. war with Iraq and is hoping a strong peace movement develops, but he has reservations about the group that organized Saturday's peace march in Washington, the ANSWER Coalition. ANSWER stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. Gitlin says this group represents the bitter end orthodoxy of the old left. I asked him about his thoughts on the march and its organizers.
Well, this is complicated. Movements are sloppy and diffuse, and in general, one prefers them that way. That is, people who are small-D Democrats don't like the sort of hierarchical command program that authoritarians embrace and find it easy to organize. Now, what that means de facto is that the organizations that are quickest to organize national demonstrations are the ones that are most hierarchically organized, and International ANSWER is one of them. So they get their fustest. They don't have complicated positions. They have simplistic positions, and they're in place like an army to follow orders and put demonstrations on the calendar.
What do you know about this group?
Their steering committee is made up of various left-wing factions, very far left-wing factions that probably total 100 members in America. The best known of them is something called the International Action Center, which is represented by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's a supporter of Slobodan Milosevic, who's a supporter of Saddam Hussein, who's a supporter of the Chinese government at Tiananmen Square. These are people with very freakish and wrongheaded positions. I mean, really appalling positions. Of course, very few people who attend these rallies have any idea of this, or for that matter, care.
Are there certain issues that ANSWER brings to the peace movement that make you uncomfortable, that you don't think belong in the peace movement?
Well, their down-the-line support for releasing Mumia Abu-Jamal, who may well deserve a fair trial, I don't know about that, but is a convicted cop killer. Has no place whatsoever in this movement. Sort of Israel is all wrong. Palestinians of all sorts are all right. Has no business in this coalition. And that's the baggage they're bringing to the party.
What are your concerns about how the leadership of the ANSWER coalition will affect the peace movement?
Well, this is difficult. Many people felt in as early as October that since they were committed to opposing the war, and Answer was the group that was promoting the demonstration, that they should go and at least take a look. I was in touch with some people who went to Answer-sponsored demonstrations, didn't like what they saw and heard, and fled. I think many more people, when it came to January and war had become more in prospect, did decide to enter into the Answer coalition, in effect, but without signing on to their principles, and wanted to go and carry their own signs. Opposing the war, opposing unilateral war at this point, is a mainstream American position. I've looked at a lot of polls. In general, about a third of the population supports unilateral war in the absence of an immediate threat to America. This is actually an enormous opportunity for an anti-war movement, because you don't have to be left-wing. You don't even have to be left of center. One of the major sites opposed to the war, antiwar.org, has a libertarian sponsorship. There are many Republicans, Heartland people aren't especially political at all, who actually are interested in turning out against the demonstration. So I think it is fruitless, in fact, counterproductive, to organize a sort of left-wing self-celebration jamboree. You'll offend a lot of people who should be opposed to the war, and you're not going to elicit the support of mainstream politicians.
Are you afraid that some of the issues and groups that the Answer Coalition is involved with will be used by some people to discredit the peace movement? I'm thinking, for instance, of Answer's affiliation with the Workers' World Party, its affiliation with other communist groups.
I am concerned that International Answer walks out to the speaker's platform wearing a big sign that says, discredit me, and that those who don't have the interests of a decent and sensible and majoritarian anti-war movement can swat the movement as a whole by pointing the finger at these absurd and reprehensible positions.
Do you feel like you're a member of of HUAC during the McCarthy era when you say this? You know, you're discrediting them because of their communist affiliations.
No, I think that they're actually dishonest in not wanting to own up to their politics. My view in the 60s was that there should be an ecumenical anti-war movement. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, organized the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War in 1965 with a very minimal position. You know, the war is bad for Vietnam, it's bad for Americans, it should be stopped, period. And we were the sole sponsor. We invited other people to come and, if they want, carry our own signs. But we were ecumenical. We did not do what Answer does. We did not fill the platform with left-wing sectarians.
Now, you were the head of SDS for a while. You were president of SDS. Mm-hmm. And SDS was a pretty radical group that endorsed pretty radical actions. And many of the more mainstream people in the anti-war movement in the 60s thought that SDS was going too far and that it would alienate the mainstream and was therefore not good for the movement. So do you feel like you're in a funny spot now, saying that there's some kind of like too far out on a limb issues involved with the peace movement now?
Well, when I was head of SDS, it was not far out on a limb. I mean, we were against the Vietnam War, but we were not, we were not embracing Ho Chi Minh or the cause of Third World Revolution. SDS went that way, and that was catastrophic, and I opposed it. My only regret is that I didn't oppose it strenuously or successfully enough. There's an awful paradox about the 1960s that today's activists must face. And it is that as the war in Vietnam became less popular, so did the anti-war movement. And the anti-war movement became less popular because it was seen as, first of all, ultra-militant, and secondly, anti-American. Much of the charge of anti-Americanism was undeserved. I mean, after all, if you had a demonstration of 100,000 people and 10,000 of them were carrying American flags, but, 100 of them were carrying Viet Cong flags and one of them was burning a U.S. flag, you know what would have ended up on the evening news that night. But the tragedy of the 60s is that while I think the anti-war movement did retard the extension of the war, the movement itself committed harakiri by isolating itself at the margins of American life and insulting most of the people who themselves were opposed to the war, who were, in fact, the proverbial mainstream people.
So you're critical of the Answer Coalition, which organized the march, the anti-war march on Saturday. Does that take away for you from the success of the demonstration and its turnout?
The turnout is a vote of confidence in the anti-war position. And, you know, the turnout was immense, striking, understood as such by the mass media, which had actually been belittling the movement before that. And I think it's important to understand that these demonstrations, especially the one in Washington, are only moments in the anti-war movement. I mean, there were demonstrations. I've been seeing listservs that to send out the word. Somebody from Santa Barbara wrote to a friend of mine that there were 5,000 demonstrators in Santa Barbara last Saturday. In a town in Maine with a population of 1,600, there were 60 demonstrators, 6-0, in the freezing cold against the war. These are not Answer supporters. There's now the important, very important action of the Catholic bishops, of the National Council of Churches, opposed to unilateral war. There's the Move On group that has collected vast numbers of signatures on petitions. The Chicago City Council, which is not a bastion of the sectarian left, voted 46-1 against unilateral war. A very sophisticated resolution, by the way, that unlike the Answer spokesman, acknowledges that Saddam Hussein is a vicious tyrant. So the demonstrations are the easiest things to notice. They get our attention. But I think this is actually a genuinely mass movement. It's happening in little places. It's in this way reminiscent of the American anti-war movement against Vietnam War circa 1969.
My guest is Todd Gitlin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's program to the emerging peace movement. My guest is Todd Gitlin. He was active in the anti-war movement of the 60s and was the head of SDS from 1963 to 64. Do you think that there are certain difficulties organizing today that would be different from the challenges of organizing in the 60s?
Well, this, first of all, let's start with the evident fact that the war is not on, and a movement of anticipation is requires a leap of imagination that the evening news and the daily dose of napalm and burning villages do not. The anti-war movement of the 60s sprang from the civil rights movement's spirit, and so there was already a mood of affirmation on the part of activists. Activists had some experience with getting results. Today's movement is springing from a very different mood, a kind of fatalism, a brooding horror about the future, which is partly a consequence of our recent political history and partly a consequence of September 11th. People are scared and they're less prone to want to oppose an American president of any sort. I think also the erosion of what I would call conventional anti-war politics or ecumenical center/liberal anti-war politics means that the sectarian groups like Answer and the International Action Center and people like Ramsey Clark and so on loom large in a way that undermines the tensile strength, the absorptiveness of the movement as a whole.
What would you say to people who are very much opposed to a war against Iraq, but at the same time don't support the agenda of International Answer?
I would say do something. Let your conscience tell you where to exercise your intelligence and your conviction. That might be going before your city council or writing letters to the paper. It might be broaching anti-war positions in your organizations. It might mean going to a big demonstration sponsored by somebody like Answer and carrying your own signs. It might mean anything that imagination will find congenial. I don't think one size fits all here. But I do think that it is not uncommon, and it is a deep and unswervable truth of political life of all sorts, that you end up in bed with people you'd just as soon not be. One does not have the luxury in political life of choosing all of your allies. That's true for leftists, rightists, centrists, everybody else.
You've attended and spoken at your share of demonstrations. Let me see if I can frame a kind of dilemma of demonstrations, you know, particularly here with the war with Iraq. It's a very complicated issue. Demonstrations aren't necessarily the best place for nuanced discussion. You know, you've got thousands, tens of thousands of people. The people who are actually at the demonstration can usually barely hear what's being said at the podium. People on TV can hear that much better. So how do you think you can still let in a certain amount of nuanced discussion and stay away from just like bumper sticker cliches at a demonstration?
Well, I would always hope that speakers, even within a few minutes, can express something of the complexity of the issue, doing something other than simply repeating chants. I think that leaflets can do that. Now websites can do that. There are many opportunities to tell one's opponents that, first of all, one is mindful of their arguments. I think that people who support the war have arguments. I don't think this one is a no-brainer. I think to be concerned about the fate of the people of Iraq is not only nice, it's morally exemplary and mandatory. I think that Saddam Hussein is not about to pounce on America, but no question that he'd like to, and so on and so on. So I think one should be mindful. I think one should always strive to elevate the level of debate and not collapse it into a sort of two legs good, four legs bad. This is a tall order, but I would insist it can be done.
You've probably seen this article. There was an article in the December 8th edition of the New York Times Sunday Magazine by George Packer. Mm-hmm. And I just want to read you an excerpt of it and get your reaction to this. It started off by saying, if you're a liberal, why haven't you joined the anti-war movement? More to the point, why is there no anti-war movement that you'd want to join? And the article goes on to discuss the liberal quandary over Iraq. And Packer writes, he speculates that the war in Bosnia converted a lot of liberals into hawks. He says, people who from Vietnam on had never met an American military involvement they liked were now calling for U.S. airstrikes to defend a multi-ethnic democracy against Serbian ethnic aggression. Suddenly, the model was no longer Vietnam. It was World War II. Armed American power was all that stood in the way of genocide. These writers and academics wanted to use American military power to serve goals like human rights and democracy, especially when it was clear that nobody else would do it. They advocated a new role for Americans in the world, which came down to American power on behalf of American ideals. What do you think of that argument, that the war in Bosnia kind of changed the equation for a lot of American liberals and turned them into hawks on some issues like Iraq, that some people who had traditionally been liberals don't oppose war in Iraq? They support overthrowing Saddam Hussein.
I think this is a true statement of what happened. I think that many liberals became selective hawks, emphasis on selective. And I would here add that many of the people who supported use of American force in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, or for that matter in Haiti, also supported it in Afghanistan. The problem is, I think many liberals today, while acknowledging that the sponsorship of the anti-war demonstrations is not, you know, their cup of democracy, don't think that Bush is their cup of democracy either. That is, under present political auspices, it's very hard to imagine that the people who were making policy in the White House, who came to office, let it be said, in a manner that was not exactly a high point in the history of democracy, that they are crusaders for democracy. I think you could well believe when Clinton intervened in Bosnia and Kosovo that he did have the interests of democracy rather than oil companies or arms manufacturers in mind. But I think the general statement that you read from George Packer's argument is accurate.
Do you think that that's affecting the type of organizing that's being done around the anti-war movement now?
Well, we see some people who think that you know, the U.S., whose slogan might as well be U.S. out of everywhere. They think that it's unimaginable that American force could ever have a just rationale or a good consequence. I'm obviously not one of those people. I dare say that most people who are opposed to war in Iraq are not pacifists, do not think that American military force is automatically the worst alternative in a situation, but are persuaded that the interests of a democratic revival in the world or extension in the world are not served by an American expedition, which can't even persuade our allies that there is a just cause. I mean, there are many people, not just liberals, who I think are walking into an anti-war movement which they're in the process of manufacturing, whether it's voting in behalf of an anti-war resolution in the Chicago City Council or demonstrating hither and yon.
What do you think an anti-war movement needs to do now to actually be effective in stopping or limiting a war against Iraq?
I think it needs to resort to a panoply of legitimate tactics ranging from lobbying members of Congress to getting resolutions out of city and state assemblages to working within churches and synagogues and so on. I think they need to do wholehearted and intellectually respectable and morally complex work to establish that they or we are the mainstream. I think, in short, it's a moment to establish the immensity of this movement, not to up the militancy, as some would argue, but to underscore the normalcy of this commitment, so that those who are in charge, who are reckoning on their political careers, will take note. I wouldn't want to say that this movement is going to have an easy time standing in front of the Bush bulldozer, but there is no alternative than to try.
Todd Gitlin, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Terry.
Todd Gitlin is the author of the book Media Unlimited, which has just come out in paperback. His next book, Letters to a Young Activist, will be published in the spring. Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the New Peace Movement. We talk with one of the organizers of last Saturday's anti-war march in Washington, Mara Verheiden Hilliard. She's on the steering committee of the Answer Coalition. And we hear from Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches and co-chair of the new coalition, Win Without War. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're looking at the new anti-war movement. My guest, Mara Verheiden Hilliard, is on the steering committee of the group that organized Saturday's peace march in Washington, the ANSWER Coalition. ANSWER stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. She's also a co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice. As we heard earlier in an interview with Todd Gitlin, ANSWER has been criticized by some people within the peace movement for tying the movement to extreme or fringy political positions that anti-war demonstrators are often not even aware of. ANSWER has also been examined in several articles, including one by Michelle Goldberg, published by the internet magazine Salon in October, which was headlined, "Peace Kooks, the new anti-war movement is in danger of being hijacked by bizarre extremist groups." I talk with Mara Verheiden Hilliard about her group and Saturday's march. What do you think are the strengths of a mass rally like the one you organized in Washington, and what do you think are its limitations?
Well, I think this weekend we saw incredible mass opposition to the Bush administration's program of war and aggression, and we believe that the administration itself is quite shocked and is reeling from the lightning emergence of this massive anti-war movement. The fact that we're seeing this type of turnout of 500,000 people in Washington, 200,000 in San Francisco, at this stage, before a new bombing campaign, before a new invasion of Iraq, is really a historical moment.
I just should mention that there's been various reports on the numbers of people who turned out on Saturday. Your group is saying 500,000. I've read other estimates as well that were lower than that from both police and journalists' estimates. There were several other issues on the agenda in addition to preventing war against Iraq on Saturday, issues that were addressed from the podium, such as freeing Mumia Abu-Jamal and saying that he's a political prisoner and a victim of racism, and being in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Now, I think not everybody who opposes American intervention in Iraq would agree that Mumia Abu-Jamal is really a political prisoner or would agree with complete solidarity with the Palestinian people. Many of the people at the march would probably believe in a two-state solution in the Middle East, or they would support Israel. What would you say to those people who disagreed with other things on the agenda that were spoken of from the podium, but who saw themselves as just being there to in support of peace?
I think everyone that was heard from the stage was speaking out against the war. And we recognize that it is necessary, if you are going to fight against war and militarism, that you must recognize the fight against racism. And that racism, in fact, is a tool of militarism and oppression, that you need racism in order to be able to convince people in the United States that when children are being slaughtered in Afghanistan, their lives are less valuable than children in the United States. You need racism to convince people in the U.S. that the lives of children that will be lost in Iraq and have been lost in Iraq from sanctions are somehow less valuable than lives in the United States. And so we have many speakers who are coming from different struggles, all standing forward and standing up to say that they stand in solidarity against the war. And that really shows the depth and breadth of opposition in the United States.
The Middle East is a very divisive issue. And I'm wondering, why include it in an agenda with war against Iraq? Many people who oppose the war against Iraq wouldn't agree with a blanket statement of solidarity with the Palestinian people. Many people would support Israel. Others would support a compromise, a two-state solution. It's hard to get people to agree on the Middle East. Why undermine the consensus of the issue at hand, which is preventing war with Iraq?
I don't think there's been any undermining of any consensus because the proof is in the demonstration.
Do you think a lot of people at that demonstration really had no idea that the organizers of this particular march saw a connection between the anti-war movement regarding Iraq and the right of return for the Palestinian people?
The call for the demonstration and what we all agree on is that we are fighting against a war in Iraq. And so many different people who are coming out and who are speaking from so many different backgrounds, many of whom are the victims of U.S. Government's aggression and military intervention and control, as well as the victims of U.S. corporate domination, are coming out and standing forward and standing shoulder to shoulder. That's what's so powerful. That's what's making this so strong. I mean, certainly we have in our coalition and the people that were speaking from the stage as well, representatives of youth and students who are talking about the aspect of war and how it impacts them and their lives and their funding, as well as their being killed as they're the ones who will be sent. We had the labor community coming out in large force supporting this demonstration. And we had religious groups coming out in force. And I don't think that when a religious group comes out and supports anti-war work and traces it back to their faith, be it a faith in Christian faith, that they're somehow then telling everyone that they must all agree with the Christian faith. They're saying, this is our background. We stand here in solidarity. When Muslim groups come out to the demonstration and they speak of their beliefs, they are not telling everyone that they must worship the same. They're saying, this is the origin of our belief, and we are in solidarity with the anti-war efforts.
Another sponsor of the Peace March on Saturday was the International Action Center, which was founded by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who for years has been affiliated with many radical causes. Some of those causes have struck many people as kind of goofy. He's a member of the International Committee to Defend Slobodan Milosevic, the former head of Serbia, who's now being tried for war crimes. And the International Action Center also has links to the Workers' World Party. And I just want to read something that David Korn wrote about the Workers' World Party in the LA Weekly a few months ago in an article about their connections to a peace march. He said, the Workers' World Party is a small political sect that years ago split from the Socialist Workers' Party to support the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956. The party advocates socialist revolution and abolishing private property. It's a fan of Fidel Castro's regime in Cuba and it hails North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il for preserving his country's socialist system, which, according to the party's newspaper, has kept North Korea, quote, from falling under the sway of the transnational banks and corporations that dictate to most of the world, unquote. The party has campaigned against the war crimes trial of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. A recent Workers' World editorial declared, Iraq has done absolutely nothing wrong. Are you comfortable with the connections to the Workers' World Party?
I think it's unfortunate that you're quoting from an article that is an extremely incorrect, inaccurate, and really intended to be a divisive and offensive caricature of a political group in the United States, as well as of the people in our coalition who associate with others in our coalition. And I think using that as a basis of fact itself really is quite questionable. Now, if we want to step back and talk from a basis of reality, I think calling former Attorney General Ramsey Clark goofy really also is a rather negative reflection on even your questions at this point, to be honest, because former Attorney General Ramsey Clark is recognized not only in the United States but around the world as a man of remarkable principle and a man who has fought to defend people who he felt required and were entitled to a defense, as we would hope that everyone is. And he has fought particularly when there are situations that he has felt that the U.S. government is using its powers unfairly and unjustly in a way that really diminishes the standing of the United States worldwide. And he has sought to bring justice in that way. And he's loved around the world as well as by many people in the United States. Now, I think if we want to address the real basis of what David Korn's piece is, and even sort of those questions like, how do you feel about affiliating with people in the Workers' World Party? We all recognize that for what that is. That is basically classic McCarthyite red baiting. Now, there are some people in the International Action Center who are also in the Workers' World Party, And just because there are Marxists or socialists in an anti-war movement, that shouldn't be incredibly shocking. I think all of us in our coalition, and there are 11 major organizations who are on the steering committee, have found that those in the International Action Center have been really excellent partners in this coalition and have been really very principled and great people to work with. The nature of David Korn's article and the point of that article is to divide and diminish an anti-war movement that he has had no part in building. It's not even clear that he has an anti-war position. Frankly, he was writing articles about Afghanistan that suggested he supported military intervention there on a poor and absolutely destroyed country. Frankly, we repudiate any type of demands for a purge of the movement. We find that to be really rather offensive and quite regressive.
I know you're comparing the question to McCarthyism, but I think your critics would probably say that the problem isn't that they're afraid you're going to try to take over the world, but rather that affiliating with communism now and the communist parties that are represented within the coalition are just so irrelevant at this point, so fringy and irrelevant.
Well, I don't know which communist parties you believe are in the coalition. And when you talk about fringy and irrelevant, the relevancy of this coalition and its work is proven by the fact that we have done the mass organizing to build a really powerful anti-war movement in coalition with many people from many different backgrounds, Republicans, Democrats, Green Party members, anarchists, independents, people with no political affiliation. And that's what a real, true, broad movement is. I mean, obviously, there are many who sit on the sidelines, including former activists who are kind of armchair activists at this point, who among them haven't organized one person. And frankly, I think the line of questioning is really interesting and somewhat ludicrous. I mean, here we are a few days after the largest demonstration against the war in U.S. history at a critical moment on time on the eve of war, when we are trying to stop the slaughter of Iraqi people and stop U.S. service people from being killed needlessly and sent back in body bags. And there's some folks out there who are whining that there might be Marxists in the movement or that Mumia Abu-Jamal has an anti-war message that is shared. I think that we need to decide, as our coalition has, I would hope others would decide, that what the real objective here is right now, and that's fighting a war.
Is your group opposed to a war of all sorts? Is there ever a time that you would endorse American military intervention?
Our group is a coalition of many different organizations around the United States, and we have come together to stand for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. That is our view, which is that we are in opposition to the Bush administration's war drive and their efforts for global conquest, and we recognize the need to merge that struggle with the struggle against racism and oppression, because racism is a tool of war and militarism. That's what we have consensed on. That is the position of our coalition.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mara Verheiden-Hilliard is on the steering committee of the Answer Coalition, which organized Saturday's anti-war march in Washington. Coming up, Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches and co-chair of the new coalition Win Without War. Both groups are organizing against a war with Iraq. This is Fresh Air. We're looking at the new anti-war movement. My guest, Bob Edgar, is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, which opposes a U.S. war with Iraq. He's also the co-chair of the coalition Win Without War. Both groups have been organizing anti-war demonstrations. In December, Edgar went to Iraq with a delegation to carry out what he's described as humanitarian inspections. On Martin Luther King Day, the National Council of Churches held a prayer service and procession at the National Cathedral in Washington. The National Council of Churches helped organize Saturday's anti-war march in Washington. I asked Edgar if he's comfortable with the politics of the Answer Coalition, which organized the march.
Well, I think it's a real important question. And my experience in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now in the new century is that movements like the movement Dr. King had to move us away from segregation to civil rights and the anti-war movement of the 60s gathered around it a large coalition of people, some of whom I would feel comfortable with and some of whom would make me nervous. And one of the difficult things about working to stop this war in Iraq is that in order to build enough momentum, you've got to work with a lot of different coalitions and coalition partners. The umbrella under which most of this is operating is a group called United for Peace, and as part of that, the Answer Group is a component of it. A group of us who are part of that United for Peace, who find the tactics that go too far to one extreme or the other, formed a subset of coalition partners called Win Without War. While our people show up at these larger rallies, we have some difficulty. Often it's Al Sharpton who gets to speak rather than the Episcopal Bishop of Washington or the United Methodist Bishop of Washington. And Answer tends to focus on names that they think will draw a crowd. And I believe that while I respect their ability to gather folks, they don't speak for all of us. And that's why we ended this weekend of peacemaking with a very prayerful, thoughtful prayer vigil, which may speak much more closely to middle America as opposed to some of the issues that are raised by some of these peace partners who have other agendas.
Are you worried about those other agendas, and are you worried that the leadership, like the Answer Coalition, is going to misrepresent the agenda of the larger group of people within the peace movement, or that it would make it possible for large peace demonstrations like last Saturday's to be discredited?
I'm not so worried about it. On Saturday, I know there were people demonstrating who were from the group called Peaceful Tomorrows. These are made up of people whose family members were killed in 9/11, and I respect the fact that they went over to Iraq and they said, we've had enough victims, let's find another way. Present on Saturday were thousands of average ordinary citizens, housewives and young men and women who simply can't find justification for this war. So, yes, we would hope that some of the more radical groups would modify some of their tactics. We don't think that it's a problem to find other means and venues, even inside of big demonstrations like the one that took place on Saturday. And frankly, I think that it's unheard of to have as broad a coalition against this war before the war even starts.
Now, you're coming at this from an interesting perspective, because you're not only the head of the National Council of Churches, you're a former congressman from Pennsylvania, former Democratic congressman. You served six terms, and you were in Congress when the war in Vietnam ended. Can you talk a little bit about what impact you think peace demonstrations had on Congress during the Vietnam era?
My experience there was that in the 60s and early 70s, anyone who opposed the war was thought of as un-American, and it took organized religion a long time to come to its opposition. When we shut down the war in April of 1975, I was there on the House floor. We celebrated shutting it down, but we shut it down many, many years too late and with a lot of pulling of institutional religion. What's different today is that those religious traditions that took so long back in the 60s and early 70s are already out in front in opposition to this war. And many of them across the United States have said, we're not going to do that again. We're not going to sit back. And we think it is American. It is being a good citizen to stand up and speak out when we see injustice or when we oppose something. So I think there's a difference. And I think the difference comes from experience.
My guest is Bob Edgar, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches and co-chair of the coalition Win Without War. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the new peace movement. My guest, Bob Edgar, is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, which opposes a U.S. war with Iraq. He also co-chairs the coalition Win Without War. Do you consider yourself categorically opposed to war, or was this a difficult decision to make about the war against Iraq?
Well, I'm not categorically opposed to all wars. I think if there's a nation that is subjugating its people, we ought to intervene. I think we should have intervened in the Rwanda situation when it was clear that millions of people were being hacked to death. And I wonder why we did not intervene in that effort to at least stop the violence. But I think wars have to be just, and we need justification. So to answer your specific question, if Saddam Hussein was lobbing weapons at someone, if he was invading a neighbor, there could be some justification for war. But I think this president has won the war with Iraq. We ought to celebrate the victory. The inspectors are in. We really ought to let them inspect.
If the UN weapons inspectors do find weapons of mass destruction, would you then support bombing Iraq?
No. I think if the weapons inspectors find weapons of mass destruction, they should destroy them.
And they might think that there's others that they're not going to find, and that Saddam Hussein, if he stays in power, will use them.
Yeah, just finding the weapons isn't justification for going to war. There are 20 or 30 nations that have weapons of mass destruction. You got Pakistan and India that are 7 minutes apart by missile to each other's capital with nuclear weapons. And we've had a mixed history with both Pakistan and India. I think it's a very dangerous precedent to say we're going to bomb any nation that has weapons of mass destruction. I think that clearly we can have more confidence now that we have inspectors there. And if they find canisters, as they did a few weeks ago, destroy them, move on, look for more, add more inspectors. But I don't think that the use of military force or war is the answer to every diplomatic question that we face in our world today.
You were in Iraq in early January on a mission that you described as humanitarian inspection. And I'm wondering if you saw anything there that you didn't expect to see.
I didn't expect to see mothers huddled with their children next to incubators that were broken in the hospital. I didn't expect to see Bishop Mel Talbert of the United Methodist Church at a Chaldean Catholic church on New Year's Eve, bringing in the new year by singing "We Shall Overcome" and having the congregation respond. I was impressed with the Muslim and Christian people who together felt they could live in peace with each other. And I was very much moved by the fact that Baghdad is the size of Paris. And if we do go to war, there are going to be deaths, thousands and thousands of deaths, not just of our military people, but those very beautiful faces that we saw and the children that we met at the schools and hospitals and churches who are going to be bombed.
Bob Edgar, you're the head of the National Council of Churches. And so you're the head of a group of religious people. President Bush is a religious person, and he completely disagrees with your point of view on Iraq. The terrorists who struck us on September 11th, they were pious people. You might disagree with their interpretation of Islam, but they profess to have deep faith. So people on all sides of this right now profess deep faith about religion. I'm not sure what my question is, but I'm sure this is something you've been thinking about a lot.
Well, let me say two things. One is I think all of us suffer from our fundamentalist, whether our fundamentalists are Muslim or Christian or Jewish. We're living in a world of violence because our fundamentalists have said and acted in violent ways. Most of the major religions, particularly Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, grow out of the roots of Abraham. Abraham is the father of all three traditions. And I think it's important for those of us who find ourselves with moderate and progressive views within the broader religious community to both speak publicly and privately with each other and find those common areas of peace and justice. Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all lift high the value of peacemaking, love of the planet, care of our brothers and sisters, and particularly care of our children. And I think that it's incumbent, particularly here in the United States, for Christians, Jews, and Muslims to model different behavior. If we allow our world to be propelled into moving to the direction of our fundamentalists, we're going to find ourselves in a very violent century and in a very religious confrontation that all of us will be losers because of that.
Well, Bob Edgar, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's great to be with you, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Bob Edgar is the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches and co-chair of the new coalition, Win Without War. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships set in Northern Ontario by Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The film About a Boy is now out on video and DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the directors, brothers Chris and Paul Weitz. They also directed the comedy American Pie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.